This text was prepared by Judy Boss, Omaha, Northeast. The Rescue, A Romance of the Shallows, by Joseph Conrad, Alice. Apostrophe apostrophe quad she, that ever this should hap. For when I never, by possibility, that switch a monster or mervail might be. Apostrophe apostrophe the Franklin's tale, to Frederick Cortland Penfield, last ambassador of the United States of America to the late Austrian Empire. This old-time tale is gratefully inscribed in memory of the rescue of certain distressed travelers affected by him in the world's great storm of the year 1914. Author's note, of the three long novels of mine which suffered an interruption, The Rescue was the one that had to wait the longest for the good pleasure of the fates. I am betraying no secret when I state here that it had to wait precisely for 20 years. I laid it aside at the end of the summer of 1898, and it was about the end of the summer of 1918 that I took it up again with the firm determination to see the end of it, and helped by the sudden feeling that I might be equal to the task. This does not mean that I turned to it with elation. I was well aware, and perhaps even too much aware of the dangers of such an adventure. The amazingly sympathetic kindness which men of various temperaments, diverse views and different literary tastes have been for years displaying towards my work, has done much for me, has done all except giving me that overweening self-confidence which may assist an adventurer sometimes, but in the long run ends by leading him to the gallows. As the characteristic I want most to impress upon these short author's notes prepared for my first collected edition is that of absolute frankness, I hasten to declare that I founded my hopes not on my supposed merits, but on the continued goodwill of my readers. I may say at once that my hopes have been justified out of all proportion to my deserts. I met with the most considerate, most delicately expressed criticism free from all antagonism, and in its conclusions showing an insight which in itself could not fail to move me deeply, but was associated also with enough commendation to make me feel rich beyond the dreams of avarice, I mean an artist's avarice which seeks its treasure in the hearts of men and women. No. Whatever the preliminary anxieties might have been, this adventure was not to end in sorrow. Once more fortune favored audacity, and yet I have never forgotten the jocular translation of Odysseus Fortuna Juvet offered to me by my tutor when I was a small boy : the audacious get bitten. However, he took care to mention that there were various kinds of audacity. Oh, there are. There is, for instance, the kind of audacity almost indistinguishable from impudence. I must believe that in this case I have not been impudent, for I am not conscious of having been bitten. The truth is that, when The Rescue was laid aside, it was not laid aside in despair. Several reasons contributed to this abandonment, and, no doubt, the first of them was the growing sense of general difficulty in the handling of the subject. The contents and the course of the story I had clearly in my mind. But as to the way of presenting the facts, and perhaps in a certain measure, as to the nature of the facts themselves, I had many doubts. I mean the telling, representative facts, helpful to carry on the idea, and, at the same time, of such a nature as not to demand an elaborate creation of the atmosphere to the detriment of the action. I did not see how I could avoid becoming wearisome in the presentation of detail, and in the pursuit of clearness. I saw the action plainly enough. What I had lost for the moment was the sense of the proper formula of expression, the only formula that would suit. This, of course, weakened my confidence in the intrinsic worth, and in the possible interest of the story, that is in my invention. But I suspect that all the trouble was, in reality, the doubt of my prose, the doubt of its adequacy, of its power to master both the colors and the shades. It is difficult to describe, exactly as I remember it, the complex state of my feelings. but those of my readers who take an interest in artistic perplexities will understand me best when I point out that I dropped Irescu not to give myself up to idleness, regrets, or dreaming, but to begin the nigger of the Narcissus, and to go on with it without hesitation, and without a pause. A comparison of any page of the rescue with any page of the nigger will furnish an ocular demonstration of the nature and the inward meaning of this first crisis of my writing life. For it was a crisis undoubtedly. The laying aside of a work so far advanced was a very awful decision to take. It was wrung from me by a sudden conviction that there only was the road of salvation, the clear way out for an uneasy conscience. The finishing of the nigger brought to my troubled mind the comforting sense of an accomplished task, and the first consciousness of a certain sort of mastery which could accomplish something with the aid of propitious stars. Why I did not return to Irescu at once then, was not for the reason that I had grown afraid of it. Being able now to assume a firm attitude, I said to myself deliberately, that thing can wait. At the same time I was just as certain in my mind that out, a story which I had then, so to speak, on the tip of my pen, could not wait. Neither could Ear of Darkness be put off, for the practical reason that Mr. W.M. Blackwood, having requested me to write something for the No. M. of his magazine, I had to stir up at once the subject of that tale which had been long lying quiescent in my mind, because, obviously, the venerable MAGA editor patriarchal age of 1,000 numbers could not be kept waiting. Then Lord Jim, with about 17 pages already written at odd times, put in his claim which was irresistible. Thus every stroke of the pen was taking me further away from the abandoned rescue, not without some compunction on my part, but with a gradually diminishing resistance, till at last I let myself go, as if recognizing a superior influence against which it was useless to contend. The years passed and the pages grew in number, and the long reveries of which they were the outcome stretched wide between me and the deserted SQ like the smooth hazy spaces of a dreamy sea. Yet I never actually lost sight of that dark speck in the misty distance. It had grown very small, but it asserted itself with the appeal of old associations. It seemed to me that it would be a base thing for me to slip out of the world, leaving it out there all alone, waiting for its fate that would never come. Sentiment, pure sentiment as you see, prompted me in the last instance to face the pains and hazards of that return. As I moved slowly towards the abandoned body of the tale, it loomed up big amongst the glittering shallows of the coast, lonely but not forbidding. There was nothing about it of a grim derelict. It had an air of expectant life. One after another I made out the familiar faces watching my approach with faint smiles of amused recognition. They had known well enough that I was bound to come back to them. But their eyes met mine seriously, as was only to be expected, since I, myself, felt very serious as I stood amongst them again after years of absence. At once, without wasting words, we went to work together on our renewed life, and every moment I felt more strongly that they who had waited bore no grudge to the man who, however widely he may have wandered at times, had played truant only once in his life. 1920. J. C. Contents, Part 1. The Man and the Brig, Part 2. The Shore of Refuge, Part 3. The Capture, Part 4. The Gift of the Shallows, Part 5. The Point of Honor and the Point of Passion, Part 6. The Claim of Life and the Toll of Death, Part 1. The Man and the Brig, the shallow sea that foams and murmurs on the shores of the thousand islands, big and little, which make up the Malay Archipelago, has been for centuries the scene of adventurous undertakings. The vices and the virtues of four nations have been displayed in the conquest of that region that even to this day has not been robbed of all the mystery and romance of its past, and the race of men who had fought against the Portuguese, the Spaniards, the Dutch and the English has not been changed by the unavoidable defeat. They have kept to this day their love of liberty, their fanatical devotion to their chiefs, their blind fidelity in friendship and hate all their lawful and unlawful instincts. Their country of land and water, for the sea was as much their country as the earth of their islands, has fallen a prey to the Western race, the reward of superior strength, if not of superior virtue. Tomorrow the advancing civilization will obliterate the marks of a long struggle in the accomplishment of its inevitable victory. The adventurers who began that struggle have left no descendants. The ideas of the world changed too quickly for that. But even far into the present century they have had successors. Almost in our own day we have seen one of them, a true adventurer in his devotion to his impulse, a man of high mind, and of pure heart, lay the foundation of a flourishing state on the ideas of pity and justice. He recognized chivalrously the claims of the conquered. He was a disinterested adventurer, and the reward of his noble instincts is in the veneration with which a strange and faithful race cherish his memory. Misunderstood and traduced in life, the glory of his achievement has vindicated the purity of his motives. He belongs to history. But there were others, obscure adventurers who had not his advantages of birth, position, and intelligence, who had only his sympathy with the people of forests and sea he understood and loved so well. They cannot be said to be forgotten, since they have not been known at all. They were lost in the common crowd of seamen traders of the archipelago, and if they emerged from their obscurity it was only to be condemned as lawbreakers. Their lives were thrown away for a cause that had no right to exist in the face of an irresistible and orderly progress, their thoughtless lives guided by a simple feeling. But the wasted lives, for the few who know, have tinged with romance the region of shallow waters and forest-clad islands that lies far east and still mysterious between the deep waters of two oceans. I, out of the level blue of a shallow sea, Karamata raises a lofty barrenness of gray and yellow tints, the drab eminence of its arid heights, separated by a narrow strip of water, Suroten. To the west, shows a curved and ridged outline resembling the backbone of a stooping giant, and to the eastward a troop of insignificant islets stand effaced, indistinct, with vague features that seem to melt into the gathering shadows. The night following from the eastward the retreat of the setting sun advanced slowly, swallowing the land and the sea, the land broken, tormented and abrupt. The sea smooth and inviting with its easy polish of continuous surface to wanderings facile and endless. There was no wind, and a small brig, that had lain all the afternoon a few miles to the northward and westward of Karamata, had hardly altered its position half a mile during all these hours. The calm was absolute, a dead, flat calm, the stillness of a dead sea, and of a dead atmosphere. As far as the eye could reach there was nothing but an impressive immobility. Nothing moved on earth, on the waters, and above them in the unbroken luster of the sky. On the unruffled surface of the straits the brig floated tranquil and upright, as if bolted solidly, keel to keel, with its own image reflected in the unframed and immense mirror of the sea. To the south and east the double islands watched silently the double ship that seemed fixed amongst them forever, a hopeless captive of the calm, a helpless prisoner of the shallow sea. Since midday, when the light and capricious airs of these seas had abandoned the little brig to its lingering fate, her head had swung slowly to the westward, and the end of her slender and polished jib boom, projecting boldly beyond the graceful curve of the bow, pointed at the setting sun, like a spear poised high in the hand of an enemy. Right aft by the wheel the Malay quartermaster stood with his bare, brown feet firmly planted on the wheel grating, and holding the spokes at right angles, in a solid grasp, as though the ship had been running before a gale. He stood there perfectly motionless, as if petrified, but ready to tend the helm, as soon as fate would permit the brig to gather way through the oily sea. The only other human being then visible on the brig's deck was the person in charge. A white man of low stature, thick set, with shaven cheeks, a grizzled mustache, and a face tinted a scarlet hue by the burning suns, and by the sharp salt breezes of the seas. He had thrown off his light jacket, and clad only in white trousers and a thin cotton singlet, with his stout arms crossed on his breast upon which they showed like two thick lumps of raw flesh, he prowled about from side to side of the half poop. On his bare feet he wore a pair of straw sandals, and his head was protected by an enormous pith hat, once white, but now very dirty, which gave to the whole man the aspect of a phenomenal and animated mushroom. At times he would interrupt his uneasy shuffle athwart the break of the poop, and stand motionless with a vague gaze fixed on the image of the brig in the calm water. He could also see down there his own head and shoulders leaning out over the rail, and he would stand long, as if interested by his own features, and mutter vague curses on the calm which lay upon the ship like an immovable burden, immense and burning. At last, he sighed profoundly, nerved himself for a great effort, and making a start away from the rail managed to drag his slippers as far as the binnacle. There he stopped again, exhausted and bored. From under the lifted glass panes of the cabin skylight nearby came the feeble chirp of a canary, which appeared to give him some satisfaction. He listened, smiled faintly, muttered "Icky, poor Dick," and fell back into the immense silence of the world. His eyes closed, his head hung low. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.